At this time of the year, it's interesting to think about what our culture is like when we see what we have done with Christmas. So for quite a few generations now, Christmas has been celebrated in Western culture as the birth of Christ. But as we drift from our Judeo-Christian heritage, what do we do with a festival that completely and overtly celebrates the birth of Jesus? And even Santa Claus, whose origins go back to a Christian guy called Saint Nicholas, who used to give gifts to poor families, has been substantially altered to suit our preferences. So one thing that we self-evidently do is that we make a popular commercial version of Santa bigger and we make Jesus less. And what we show by this is that what we think we need and our kids need is more stuff rather than a deep transforming redemption. There is almost a sinister irony about the fact that we have turned an occasion for celebrating our redemption into an orgy of stuff that we need redeeming from. But as we reflect on this final chapter of Ruth, it focuses us on the nature of our redemption and what the extravagant redemptive kindness of God looks like in a real situation for real people. So by way of reminder, we're in the time of the Judges, which was a dark and chaotic time in the life of God's people Israel, where everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And we've seen so far in Ruth that there was a famine in Bethlehem, which means house of bread. And a man called Elimelech, which means my God is king, left the place of God's specific kingship, the promised land, to go and find food and quite wrongly took his family to an enemy land, Moab. In doing this, he did the wrong thing and showed unbelief in the promises of God, which were tied to the land. Elimelech died, and his two sons married Moabite women, which was expressly forbidden in the law, their names being Orpah and Ruth. The two sons also died, which left Naomi and her two daughter-in-laws by themselves. Naomi decided to go back to the land of Judah, probably one of the first good decisions that's been made in the book of Ruth to that point, because God had come to the aid of his people by providing food. She released her daughter-in-laws from their obligation to look after her and told them to go back and find rest among their own people and their own gods. So Naomi returned empty and bitter, her name meaning pleasant or delightful. Ruth refused to go back, though, because she wanted to be included in the Lord's promises. She had been converted. When they got back, Ruth, demonstrating the fruit of her conversion, provided for Naomi by picking up grain after the harvesters, which is how poor people survived, the centrelink of ancient Israel. As it happened in God's providence, she ended up working in the paddock of a close relative of Naomi's called Boaz. Boaz was a generous, godly man who took care of these women. And so eventually Ruth appropriately made herself available to Boaz as a wife because he was a kinsman redeemer. A kinsman redeemer is someone who would marry the wife of a dead family member to provide children for the dead person to continue his family and property. But there was a closer relative to Naomi who had first option to buy this land of Naomi that she was selling and therefore marry Ruth also. So in chapter 4, we see how this situation is resolved. They returned to the land and found that there was a redeemer, but will he be able to redeem them? The issue at stake in all this is whether or not Ruth's putting herself under the shelter of the Lord's wings is worthwhile. Will God's promises to Abraham be realised or given full expression in the life of Naomi and Ruth? They have no descendants to carry on the family name. They have to sell their land because of poverty. Is Ruth's forsaking her old gods and putting her trust in the Lord, is it well founded? Will she be redeemed from her situation? Has she invested her hope in the right place? And straight away, verses 1 and 2, we see that the godly Boaz is following through on his commitment to be the family redeemer by sorting out this issue of there being a redeemer closer in line than him. He said, "Today I will resolve it." And he went straight to the place of legal transaction, the gate of the city, got a suitable number of elders together to resolve it. And just as Ruth happened to find herself in the field of Boaz, behold, here comes this other redeemer. And they adopt the serious seating position of legal transaction. In the previous chapter, there was a lot of lying down in anticipation of Boaz and Ruth lying down in marriage. Now there is a lot of sitting down to resolve the legal obstacles to the full redemption for Naomi's family. So verses 3 and 4, Boaz begins by explaining how some land belonging to Naomi needs redeeming, and he is the closest relative, and he should act on his redemptive obligations. And he agrees, because at this stage in his mind, he gets some more land, and all he has to do for it is to look after a widow. It's a good financial arrangement. But verse 5, Boaz probably quite shrewdly leaves this other little bit to last. He lays on him the less attractive component, which is that he would also have to marry Ruth, the Moabite, to raise up children for Naomi's family. When he hears this verse 6, he suddenly no longer wants to be the redeemer. See, this would be less attractive to him because if she has a son by him, that son would then inherit the land, and he would also have to provide for many more people. It's important to see here that this redeemer is not named, whereas the names of people and places in Ruth are otherwise very important, because he is a lesser character, helping us understand what is going on here by providing a contrast to Boaz. This other redeemer is really more worried about the finances of it all rather than the well-being of Naomi and Ruth. How this guy is not being cast here is as a wicked person. This person's not a wicked person. He's a normal, sensible person. He has bills to pay. Probably already has enough kids to cart around to soccer training and educate. So verse 6 is very ironic, because it says the redeemer said, "I cannot redeem." It's like a driver saying, "I cannot drive." How can a redeemer not redeem? And this provides a stark contrast to Boaz, doesn't it? Because the reason Boaz's redemption is superior and makes effective the promises to Abraham in this family is because, as we've seen, it's built on a far superior principle. This unnamed redeemer is acting purely out of obligation and how the numbers work out. Boaz is acting on chesed, on the loving, faithful kindness that flows from Yahweh himself. See, the point here is that the redemption that God has in mind is a redemption of extravagant kindness and utter faithfulness to the well-being of his people, not some number-crunching obligation. Boaz is a pattern of God's incredible generosity to helpless people. See, if you're in serious trouble, you don't want a normal, sensible person. You want an extravagant, kind, and generous person to help you. So Boaz made his intentions clear, verses 9 and 10, and sealed the deal legally by accepting his sandal in front of the elders. I wish the handing over of a shoe was all that it costs to make legal transactions today. The cost is more like the foot, isn't it, than the shoe. But of course, this redemption costs more than just his sandal. It would be financially costly. Because we see from verse 10, and we must keep this in mind, redemption is not for the benefit of the Redeemer, but for the benefit of those needing redemption. But for generous people, cost is not so much of an issue. See, redemption is costly, which is why normal, sensible people don't make good redeemers. Full redemption requires extravagance, kindness, generosity, and goodness. And now in verses 11 and 12, we get the perspective of the people who are observing all this take place. And they pronounce an extraordinary blessing on this outcome. So look at verse 11. It's an extraordinary blessing considering that previously Ruth was just the Moabite. This Moabite who's come back from the country of Moab. Now she's being named in the same breath as Leah and Rachel, the wives of Jacob who built up the 12 tribes of Israel. This is pronouncing the blessings of Abraham on Ruth and Boaz. May God bless their union in such a way that it blesses Israel, that it redeems God's people in a way. And verse 12 almost seems strange, doesn't it? Why would you include in this blessing the situation of Judah and Tamar? For those who don't remember, the son of Jacob called Judah had a daughter-in-law called Tamar. And ironically, in this context, he didn't actually obey the Levitical law by giving another of his sons to Tamar as a husband after the previous two had died. So Tamar acted as a prostitute, seduced and became pregnant by Judah, her father-in-law. So in a sense, Judah and Tamar was a marriage according to the law in Leviticus, but a very strange example of such a marriage, surrounded by deception and disobedience. But there are a couple of reasons why it's mentioned here in this blessing. One is Boaz comes from this family. Tamar's son Perez was his ancestor. So Boaz exists because of that union. Also, even though it was unusual in God's providence, it had the effect of building up descendants for Abraham. This case of Ruth and Boaz has some similarities. See, it's hard for us to grasp how much it would have stuck in the throat that Ruth the Moabite is now an ancestor of King David. See, this is establishing a pattern that God does not always use conventional means to achieve his purposes, but he will achieve them. The seed that will crush the serpent's head, the ultimate seed of Abraham, the son of David, he must come. And this is why verse 13 is basically all action. There's 13 Hebrew words in verse 13. Five of them are verbs. Took, married, went in, given conception, gave birth. Suddenly it's all action. After all the uncertainty, all the tedium of gleaning, after all the bitterness of coming back empty, there is a Redeemer. A Redeemer is born. And we're reminded again in verse 13 that it was the Lord who brought all this about, and he is the one that enabled Ruth to have a son. He gave her conception. And this son would be a blessing for two main reasons, which are given to us in verses 14 to 17. Firstly, he would be a blessing because this child would be a family redeemer. This is the third redeemer mentioned in this chapter. He would care for the family in old age, provide food, continue descendants, keep the land in Naomi's family. This son has literally redeemed this family. He has brought security and comfort to what began as a disastrous situation for Naomi. And verse 15 is really important in this whole account because some people want to cast this book as a love story. And no doubt, reading between the lines, there are elements of that. But if we see it primarily as that, we miss the main point. Because there is never the mention of the attractiveness of any of the people. This isn't a love story in a classic sense. And the main reason we know that it's not is because the Hebrew verb love is only used once in this entire book, and it's in this verse, in verse 15. And it's not used about Ruth and Boaz. It's used by the people who are observing this situation, and they say, look at the extraordinary nature of Ruth, the Moabite. They say to Naomi, your daughter-in-law who loves you more than seven sons. See, we're reminded again here that in the Bible, in the biblical thinking, love is not primarily a feeling, but an action, or better still, many actions for the good of another. Think about this whole story, what Ruth has done for Naomi. She worked hard gleaning in the fields, and from her apron brings forth grain for Naomi. She offers herself in marriage to Boaz, primarily according to the text, for the sake of the redemption of Naomi. Now in verse 16, from her uterus she produces her son and gives him to the lap of Naomi. To the extent, verse 17, that it said that Naomi has a son. See, this is extraordinary generosity and kindness and redemption. But it's not through the expected or usual means, which might be seven sons. It's through a Moabite daughter-in-law, who in her own redemption from idols becomes the agent of Naomi's redemption. Naomi was bitter and empty, and the Lord has filled her up again by the Moabite who loves her more than seven sons. Ruth has shown extraordinary chesed, covenant kindness, extravagant faithfulness towards Naomi. In chapter 1, Ruth was invisible to Naomi, because Naomi just said, look, I've come back empty. Well, where's Ruth? But Ruth was always there. Naomi just didn't see how God was manifesting his covenant kindness all along. even in her failure and sin. And the fact that this child is named Obed by the people, which means servant, may anticipate the greater coming servant of Yahweh, through whom the complete redemption of Israel will emerge. And we see something of this anticipation in verses 17 to 22. We see that this will be the line from which the great King David will be born. See, 1,200 years after this, another baby was born, who would be the ultimate redeemer, the world's redeemer. Have you ever wondered why the Bible is so full of family trees? We'll turn to Matthew 1, which was read for us before. And the basic reason is that the Old Testament is looking for someone. It's looking for the Messiah or Christ, looking for the one who will reverse the effects of human rebellion in Eden, looking for the ultimate offspring of Abraham. The redemption of Ruth, Boaz and Obed, the redemption they provided was great, but limited. These people did not overcome death. They did not provide a way for us to be completely right with God. Not even David could do that. What we need is a redeemer who can buy us back from our enemies of sin and death. We need someone to purchase us from our wretchedness and enslavement to idols. So look carefully at this genealogy in Matthew 1. Remember, Matthew is a strict Jew, and usually in genealogies you only have to follow the male ancestors. But look what Matthew's done. He didn't have to say, did he, in verse 6, that Solomon was born of David, and by the way, that was by the wife of Uriah. Or that Boaz's mother was a pagan prostitute, Rahab. Or that David's grandfather was born of Ruth, the Moabite. See, it's like what Matthew's doing here is deliberately spotlighting the dodgy nature of Jesus' ancestry from a pure Jewish perspective. Because Matthew understands that the gospel is not about reinforcing people in their racial self-righteousness, but redeeming them from their wretchedness. And through Jesus, God has provided such a redeemer. Through Jesus, all of God's promises find their fulfillment or completion. The redemption in the book of Ruth is only a shadow of the redemption that Jesus would bring. Another thing we need to notice here is that this redemption is for the whole world. I don't know if you've thought about this, but Jesus is part Moabite. The whole situation of a Moabite woman such as Ruth becoming part of the people of God and an ancestor of Jesus is a reminder of God's initial promise to Abraham, isn't it? That through his offspring, he would bless the whole world. See, if we're not concerned to see the gospel reach all people, we've really not understood it properly. Another principle here is how God achieves his purposes. See, through the ordinary events of life, God achieves something quite extraordinary. Through a poor but faithful Moabite woman who was obedient to the Lord in her ordinary everyday life, God brings forth the King of Kings. Through the violent and unjust death of Jesus, God satisfies his anger against sinners and brings them into his kingdom. And it's because of this gospel we're able to lift our hopes above the horizon of career, marriage, retirement, to the hope of the day when people from all tribes and tongues are gathered around the throne on which sits the Lamb that was slain. So let's pray that in an ordinary place like Gippsland, through ordinary people like us, God might continue to achieve his extraordinary and generous purposes. That more people might say, along with Ruth, the God and Father of the Lord Jesus Christ is my God. So this Christmas, let's not endorse or get deceived by our culture's concern to minimise the theme of redemption through Christ and magnify incredibly superficial and temporary things. Just as Ruth emphasises the extravagant nature of true redemption, you will always find Jesus to be bigger and better than you could have possibly imagined. Because in the end, imitations or substitutes for real redemption just don't make it.